Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 coming to you from Building 10 inside the Microsoft campus. And today we're going to learn a little bit more about the Windows subsystem for Linux. I have a special guest here. Why don't you tell us who you are, what you do, bud?
My name is Steve. I'm a developer on the operating systems team and work for Deepu Thomas.
Fantastic. So today we're going to talk a little bit more about system calls. But before we do, just as a reminder, we've talked about general architecture. We've talked about processes. We've talked about file systems, but if you haven't watched, can you give us a little overview of how the whole bash on Windows works, or the Windows subsystem for Linux works?
Sounds great. So the first process you're going to see is bash.exe, and this is just a standard Win32 binary, basic wrapper, and then it's going to call into our user mode service to say, go ahead and launch, bash on the other side. So this is the LXSS manager service. This service will talk down into our driver, which we can call LX core or LXSS. And we'll say this is the user mode, kernel mode boundary. So user mode up here, kernel mode down here. And then at this point, the driver will go ahead and kick off the actual Linux bash process.
With all the other processes that you're running
so you
as well.
Like init, bash, and then off of bash you can run ls and all sorts of other Linux utilities.
So when we're talking about this, and now we're going to get into sort of the meat of what we're talking about, when you're making system calls on a different operating system from within a different operating system, there's got to be a whole hodgepodge of mismatch. Can you help us understand sort of where the differences are so that we can start to understand what you're doing here?
Right, yep. So that's going to be one of the pieces we talk about. Maybe to start, we can just go, what is a system call?
Let's do it.
So a system call is just a service provided by the kernel that can be called by user mode. So if you're running like a Node.js web server, examples of system calls you would do would be for device access. So if you need to read a file off of the disk, if you need to send it over the network, those are going to be system calls.
Right.
Then you also have privileged operations, like if you're doing multi-threading, need to kick off a new thread or a new process, you also make a system call down into the kernel to create that new process or thread.
So anything that is not, anything that involves like using some kind of hardware or doing something outside of your own process is always going to require a system call.
Exactly.
Cool. So can you give us an example of a process that we do in Windows that we always do that it is going to have system calls, and then maybe sort of its analogy in Linux?
Right, yeah. So an example would be if we have the ls program on Linux is comparable to the dir program on Windows.
Right.
So if we were going to run through that example.
Let's do it.
Start with the Linux version.
Okay.
So if we have the ls process running, one of the first system calls it's going to need to make is to actually query and see what files and directories are on disk that I need to expose to the user. And this will go through a system call called a getdens. And it stands for get directory entries. And we'll just pretend this takes foo and bar as parameters. OK, so on most operating systems and architectures, you're going to have three steps to make a system call. The first step you're going to have to do is marshal your parameters. And all this is you need to get the parameters that you have for your function call into a place that the kernel can read them. Then the next step you're going to have is actually make the system call with the special instruction. Right, and the third and final step is handling the return. Okay, so on Linux, the kernel has a specific ABI, which stands for Application Binary Interface, which just describes which parameters go into which registers.
I see. So we're getting registers like all the way down to like the CPU registers?
Yep.
I see. So this is like, this is not a trivial thing. And my guess is that when you're doing marshaling, you have to sort of be like, okay, this goes in this register, this goes in this register, this goes in this register, ready, go.
Yep. So typically this piece of the kernel, any transition between kernel mode and user mode is written in assembly.
Right. And that, to me, like this getdens function is going to look very different in Linux than it's going to look on Windows.
Right.
And so can you give, is this the same process that happens on Windows when you do dir?
Right, so it's going to be very similar. So let's walk through the Linux example.
Let's finish it up, yeah.
So as part of the getdens, we're going to have to move these parameters into registers. So for now, we'll use AMD64,
okay,
because that's what WSL runs on, and it's pretty straightforward. So for getDone, the first parameter for a Linux system call goes into the RDI register.
Okay.
So we'll go ahead and put foo into RDI. The second parameter is into RSI.
And which registers are those?
So these are just AMD 64 registers that are on the processor.
Got it.
And then the next thing we need to tell the kernel is what system call we want to invoke. And so this is referred to as a system call number. So in your C program, you'll have getDents, but all the kernel knows about is numbers. And that goes into RAX. So we're going to go ahead and move the number into RAX. And at this point, we finished off the marshalling. Next step is to do the special instruction. So on AMD 64, this is the syscall instruction. And what this does is it tells the processor, I'm in user mode, I want to make a system call. So the processor goes ahead and does a ring transition from user mode to kernel mode,
right,
and then starts executing in kernel mode at a specific location. So when you boot your machine, one of the pieces of initialization done by the Linux kernel is going to be setting up the system call handler. And this is just a special instruction to the CPU that says, hey, when you get a syscall instruction, go ahead, execute this line of code, and set up this environment.
Got it.
And as soon as we land in kernel mode, one of the first things it's going to do is the kernel is going to save off the user registers. This is, again, just part of the ABI. So
sure.
The Linux kernel guarantees that when your system call comes in, I'm going to preserve all your registers so you don't need to do it in user mode.
Yeah, that's nice.
Then at this point, the Linux kernel says, well, I know the system call number is in RAX, and it happens to be getDents, so I'm going to call into the getDents module. So he calls into getDents, and he passes in RDI and RSI, because he knows those are the first two parameters. So getDents finishes, returns back to the Linux kernel. The kernel restores the registers, because we want the program to continue running. And it's going to store the return value of the system call, whether or not it succeeded or failed, in RAX. So we'll say it's successful, so we'll store 0. And at this point, we need to handle the return. There's another special instruction to say, I'm in kernel mode, I want to return back to user mode. And that's the sysret. And at this point, the processor does the ring transition again, return to user mode, and we start executing again. The program should check its return value to make sure everything was successful.
So once it has the return value, there's got to be some data that the kernel passes back. Does it put that in a special register or somewhere on the heap or somewhere for the process to access?
So the data, the only register the kernel returns back to user mode is RAX for the return value. Mm-hmm. Everything else is done in pointers. So for getDents, if it needed to fill out some sort of buffer, the kernel would just operate on that user mode buffer itself.
I see. So it just like have a pointer inside the process of the heap, and then it would just use that information.
Right.
Interesting. So if the system call was like read from a socket, it would return in RAX 0, got data, mm-hmm. and then that packet data would be inside the heap somewhere.
Right, inside of one of the pointers that was passed in.
Excellent. Okay. So this is how Linux makes system calls,
yep.
which is very methodical, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to do it this way. How does it do it on the Windows side?
Right, so I guess we can do the equivalent example on NT and just run through how it works with DIR. So the DIR system, or the DIR program, will need to talk to NT the way that NT expects. And NT has a slightly different ABI, but it follows the same steps we have here, which is marshalling, running a special instruction, then returning. So on the NT side, the system call he's going to use, there's no getDents. It's going to be NT query file. So we have NT query. And let's say that takes in bar and baz.
Okay.
And then this system call is, again, going to translate into assembly. We'll just walk through that real quick so we can see the differences. So again, RAX is going to hold the system call number, just like we saw in Linux. But one difference we have is that the first two parameters on Windows go into RCX and RDX. So it just expects them in different registers. Say bar, and RDX is baz. Okay, so now we've finished off our marshalling, and we're going to run our special instruction.
Uh-huh.
Same thing as Linux, it's going to be the syscall instruction on AMD 64. And then when we enter the NT kernel this time, the NT kernel is only going to save off a subset of the registers. So the ABI for this, for the NT, is that it doesn't preserve the volatile registers. So there's a certain set of registers that will actually be saved by the compiler as a separate step up here. So on NT, we have this save volatiles. And this is done by the compiler.
I see. What you mean by the compiler is that it emits additional instructions before a system call is made to save all the volatile registers.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then there's no reason to resave them in the kernel. It would just be wasting cycles in space.
And so what's happening is the compiler takes care of something that the Linux kernel would otherwise do.
Right. Okay. Exactly.
Got it.
Okay, so at this point, the NT kernel says, look in RAX for the system call number. It's NT query file. And then it's going to grab the first two parameters from RCX and RDX, run the call. Once the call finishes, we restore the registers, put the return value in RAX, and do the sysread. So as we can see, really the only difference we have between these two cases is how the parameters are marshaled over. Everything else is identical.
And then obviously the other thing that happens is step zero here is the compiler is going to emit additional instructions to save volatile registers.
Exactly.
Before every system call.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now that we know sort of down to the CPU what's happening, let's pop back out to we're actually in the Windows subsystem for Linux. When these calls are being made by the binaries in Linux, there's got to be some rewriting that's happening in LXSys. Or what is it that's happening so that these things are doing the right thing?
Right. So to walk through that, we can just go through what would happen if we ran ls on WSL.
Let's
and then
do it.
Call out the differences. Okay, so we're back to our friend ls. But now we're running on the NT kernel.
Right.
And so as you saw before, this is just a standard ELF binary. Only knows how to make system calls the Linux way,
right.
So it's going to marshal its parameters the same way it did before. Okay, but then when we execute the syscalls, when things get a little interesting. So inside of the NT kernel, it takes a look at the process and it says, oh, this is a special type of process. It's called a Pico process.
Right.
It's used for running subsystems on top of NT, so I have no idea how to handle this system call. I'm going to go ahead and save off all of his registers. Then at this point, it forwards a request over to a driver, which is our Pico driver, the LXSS. And it passes the registers over to the driver. But our driver knows how to handle the Linux system calls. It takes a look in RAX and says, OK, this is getDunce. I have a getDunce implementation. I can call into that. And passes over the two parameters it expects, handles the call, turns back to the NT kernel. NT kernel restores all the registers, puts the return value in RAX, and does the sysread.
And so it's the same thing. And so the LXSS implementation of getDunce is effectively a forwarder to NT query. Is that right?
At the end of the day, it will end up calling into NT query.
I see. And so here's the thing, like, and this is where I think all of a sudden it's becoming clear to me the complexity of this. Is I thought that when the system call was made, it just trapped it and did something else. But effectively, when you're looking at the ELF64 binary, it's actually making these special instructions. And the operating system says, oh, you're a Pico process. I don't know what to do with this. Is there a driver associated with this? There better be. Here it is. And then she's going to go ahead and say, OK, I know what getDunce is. And then it's going to forward it off.
Exactly.
Okay, so here's the next question. There's got to be a time where, I mean, how do you implement this for all system calls? I mean, it feels like it would be a laborious, like, you're going to the man page, right? Because you're not looking at the source code. You're going to the man page. You're saying, this does this. All right, let's see what it does in NT. All right, there's got to be some weird cases where you're like, this system call equals like two of these system calls.
Right.
I mean, can you tell me some of the system calls that you implemented that you're like, oh, what do we do with this one?
Right, so one of the ones we did recently, it's a Linux system call called fallocate.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically a Swiss Army knife system call of manipulating files. So it has about five or six different operations. You can extend a file, you can take away parts of a file, you can shift a file around into different pieces. So because it was file system specific, it ended up mapping probably into about eight or nine different NT system calls that we had to forward it off to.
With a lot of if and else statements,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so here's the other interesting thing. When you're doing the system call, people maybe take this to be some kind of magical, like it's going off into this to the super hyper secure land, but it's really just code, right? That it's calling.
Right. Yep. So parts of this are written in assembly, just the parts we need to marshal specific registers, but the rest of it is just standard C.
I see. So, I mean, I'm trying to get a sense for it because as a developer, I have these curious, super curious. How long does it take to implement a system call? I mean, does it depend on the system call? I mean, how much research? Because everybody knows, I mean, when you're writing code, the last thing you do is you write the code and that's the fastest part. All the other part is just research and understanding, right?
Right, so it all depends on the system call. An example of one that worked out really nicely, so Linux has a system call called yield. What it allows you to do, it tells the kernel, hey, if there's any other thread that could potentially run, go ahead and run them instead of me. It's basically like preempt the current thread if there's someone else waiting. And that happens to just map one-to-one with an existing NT system call. So that one was, you know, maybe took an hour at most to go ahead and code that up.
I see. What was your hardest system call that you had to implement when it comes to mapping?
Hardest system call? I'd probably go with one of the clone system call. Uh-huh. So it's a system call that allows you to create new processes or threads. And again, it has so many different options compared to NT with different flags. Uh-huh. And just going through all the different cases and figuring out which ones we can support and which ones we can't support.
And now this brings me to the next one, which I'm super curious about. Yeah. Because I remember the first time I made this system call in an operating systems class, I was like, this is very different than I would expect. Like the way you create a process in mm-hmm. Linux is you effectively copy the current process entirely and then rewrite stuff in there.
Yep.
That's not how you do stuff in Windows.
Exactly.
And that system call, as we all know, is fork. Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
Right, so fork is actually just a special case of clone that says, basically create an identical copy of the current process and let it run. So for the fork system call, when that comes into the NT kernel, it says again, you know, this is a Pico process, I have no idea how to handle it, and gives it to our LXSS Pico driver, and we have a clone module which handles all of these pieces. So the first step it's going to do is do some prep work and make sure the system or the process is in a good state. And the next piece we're going to do is we're going to call back into the NT kernel, and we're going to say, create a new process, duplicate the handle table of the existing process.
What's a handle table?
So a handle table is where we store your different file descriptors. So if we were to go and open up some files on disk, at the end of the day, it ends up in the kernel as a handle table.
Sure.
So we create a copy of that because we want the new process to be identical, running side by side. Another flag we pass in is, say, create this process with cloned memory semantics, which means create an identical address space for the two of them. So at that point, we have a new process. And so like if your process was running here, we'd have a NT process with no threads in it. Uh-huh. Then the next piece we need to do is create a thread to run in this process. And again, call into NT, say create a thread, and we get the thread inside of here. At this point, the thread doesn't really have a context or state associated with it. So we need to copy the context from this thread and apply it to the thread here.
Right.
And then we have to do some more follow-up work to do things like copy on write and other pieces.
I see. So effectively, it's exactly the same process. But when you're looking at the sort of the call stack and the heap and everything, the memory addressing looks the same. It's pointing to different spots in the memory, obviously, because it's going to work on different things. When that happens, I mean, you're saying that you're asking NT to make a process, but it's not an NT process, right?
So. One of the other flags we pass in is say it's one of these special Pico processes.
I see. And so clone is sort of the one that implements all of that work, and fork is sort of another one that does the same kind of thing, right?
Right. So fork is a special case of clone.
I see. Because this doesn't exist in Windows at all.
Right. There's no Win32 API you can call to fork a process. It's all just create process, and you get a brand new process from the beginning.
And so it's interesting to me then that clone was the hardest one that you had to implement. I mean, it's easy to get that wrong. There's got to be some iterations you went through where things just started, like, acting super weird.
Right, and there's just so many different flags they support. Like, you can choose whether or not you want to share the address space, whether or not you want to share the handle table, the signal dispositions. There's uh-huh. just so many different options and combinations.
Oh, man. Now, so as we're going forward, are people... Like, what are some of the bugs that people are finding? So obviously, this isn't done all the way yet. Mm-hmm. What are some of the interesting bugs that you're finding in the system calls themselves? as you're forwarding, redirecting, or re-implementing on top of NT some Linux stuff?
I'd probably break down into two categories. The first would be just behavior we didn't expect. Like an example was we hit the other day on the GitHub forums, which was super helpful, is someone was calling write with a size of 0 but an invalid buffer. So inside of our driver, what we ended up doing is we were always checking the buffer first and making sure it was valid, even if the size was 0.
And I see.
The behavior in Linux is if the size is 0, they completely ignore the buffer. So we had to update our driver to handle this case to be able to support this binary running.
There's got to be a lot of crazy sort of side things like that that you're coming across. I mean, you're working on this obviously every day. What kind of impact has the user feedback been for you guys?
The user feedback has been great, especially from a compatibility angle. Like, we can code all day long with the man pages, but when it actually, an application depends on something, we have to implement it or it doesn't run. So it's been awesome to see all the different pieces that we need to hit, and especially for prioritizing what's going to come next.
So talking about system calls, are you completely done implementing all the system calls that are available, or are there some that you're still working on and we should look forward to?
So I think the Linux kernel implements around 300 or so system calls.
That's not a lot. I mean, that's surprisingly very little.
Right. Compared to NT, NT is in the several hundreds, probably closer to 1,000.
Uh-huh.
I think of those, we have about 150 to 200 implemented, so there's actually a large gap of system calls, but a lot of those are used for more specialized applications.
Well, that's awesome. Well, where can people go to find out more about this stuff?
So after this video, we're going to do a blog write-up to help solidify some of this.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us. We've been learning about the Windows subsystem for Linux, particularly system calls, and one of my favorites in Linux, fork. Thanks so much for watching. My name is Seth Juarez, Channel 9. We'll see you next time. Take care.